podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
All around the world, genetic science is profoundly changing the research and development of therapeutic intervention. This progress is also driving corresponding advancements in the science that supports the regulatory review and approval of these therapies. But how close is this future to meeting the needs of patients today? I am Ranjini Prithviraj, Global Associate Director for Pantan Collaboration at DIA, and with me is Dr. Emily Drabant-Conley. Emily is the Vice President of Business Development for 23andMe, the genomics and biotechnology company best known for their personal genetic test, and the first company to receive US FDA approval to provide genetic health results directly to consumers. Emily, welcome, and thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So 23andMe has certainly had its ups and downs with the FDA, but in February 2015, you received your first FDA approval for a test for carrier status authorization. Now, since then, you've received four more approvals from the FDA with your latest just this January. Congratulations. What are some of the lessons learned from these various regulatory experiences?
Yeah, it's a great question. So in each case, there were kind of three core things that we needed to demonstrate to the FDA. The first was analytical validity, essentially that our genotyping technology was accurately measuring a customer's genotype. The second was clinical validity. So when we interpreted that genotype to say that it meant something about their risk for a certain disease, that the clinical interpretation was valid. And then the third was user comprehension. So could individuals, lay individuals without any advanced scientific training, understand their genetic results directly without the intervention of a healthcare provider? Were they able to understand the limitations of the test and what the results specifically meant for them and their risk of disease? And so we were able to demonstrate those three things, the analytical validity, clinical validity, and user comprehension, both in that first FDA submission and then the subsequent four authorizations that we have received from the FDA since then. So we're regulated as a class two medical device. And in terms of some of the, you know, the things that we've learned, I think there's been a lot of learning on our side as a company in Silicon Valley to really bolster our understanding of the regulatory process. We've built out a lot of infrastructure within the company and really made this a pillar and a kind of a core strength of ours. And then I think we've also been able to educate the FDA a bit. This is a really new field, this concept of direct-to-consumer genetic testing. You know, it's a lot of information that we're conveying to consumers. How do you do that in a way that's safe and effective? And that's something that we've been able to kind of pioneer together. So when you look at the first approval that we got, it took about 2 years to get that approval. And the time in between approvals is now shortening. Then the next one was like about a year after that. And then it was months. And then we just received an approval late last year. And then, you know, about 3 or 4 months later, we received another approval. So the cadence is getting faster, I think, as we've really kind of set the foundation of a process with the FDA that we can follow together.
What you said about user comprehension was really interesting. How do you convey that users actually comprehend the test the way you intend them to?
You have to measure it directly. So we had to do a vast number of user comprehension studies where we went to individuals from all different backgrounds, from all geographies across the United States, and presented them with our genetic results, with what the actual reports look like, and then tested them afterwards to understand, did the result make sense? Did they somehow misinterpret that information? And we had to do that to an extremely high threshold to meet the FDA standards. And so for all of our submissions, that's something that we've had to go through. And I think it's a real strength of the product. One of the things that we pride ourselves on is the ability to take pretty complicated scientific information and help distill it down for, you know, a lay audience, because we think, you know, genetics is about everybody. This is information that's really fundamental to you and your health. We want your grandmother or you to be able to understand it, or, you know, people in all parts of the country that may not have access to kind of advanced scientific training. And we really believe that people can do that. And so the user comprehension studies, they've helped kind of improve our product, and they've also really demonstrated that people can understand this information.
Now, among other things, your tests have provided information about predisposition to breast cancer and even genetic variants in a hereditary colorectal cancer syndrome. Can you estimate how many lives these tests may have helped save?
Certainly, thousands of lives. Thousands of lives. I think in the case of breast cancer in particular, what's really interesting with the BRCA variants is that there are really strict guidelines in place currently for BRCA testing. So if you go to your physician, you have to meet these stringent guidelines that are typically around family history of cancer as well as ethnicity in order to be eligible for BRCA testing. And a lot of people don't know their family medical history, and in some cases also don't even know accurately their ethnicity. They may have some Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry that they don't know about. And so therefore, you know, they would miss meeting the guidelines and therefore never be tested. We actually have studies which suggest that as many as 50% of people that carries one of these BRCA mutations in our database would not qualify for the traditional screening. And so we believe that this test is a great tool. We view it as a screen. You know, it has limitations. It doesn't cover all BRCA variants. But for people with Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry, we cover about 85 to 90% of the variants that they may have if they indeed have one of these variants. And if you carry one, as you said, you know, it's life-altering. Your risk of cancer goes up, in some cases, as high as 85%. And so we have thousands of customers that have tested positive through us and found out this information and then been able to go and work with their healthcare professional to take the appropriate next steps.
There is a lot of interest in the use of real-world data and real-world evidence to support regulatory decision-making. Now, 23andMe is a treasure trove of phenotypic patient-reported data. Could you tell us a little bit about how the data you have is being used to help accelerate treatments to patients?
This is a great question, and I think it's something that is not always appreciated about 23andMe. We're best known for the genetic testing that we do, but a lot of people don't realize that we have a huge focus on research. So when customers join 23andMe, we invite them to participate in research via an IRB-approved protocol. Over 80% of our customers opt in to participate in that protocol. And then we collect data, self-reported data online about our customers. And on average, our customers answer about 350 questions a piece about their background. So diseases they've been diagnosed with, you know, medications they've taken, different health behaviors like smoking, alcohol consumption, et cetera. And so for many years now, we've been mining this data to make research discoveries. So we've published over 120 peer-reviewed papers. And about 4 years ago, we launched a therapeutics division with the goal of mining this data set to accelerate target identification. And so it's been really exciting to see that effort take shape. It's run by Richard Scheller, who was formerly the head of early R&D at Genentech for almost 15 years. And in the short time that the team has been together, we've now identified a number of novel therapeutic targets, and we have 13 preclinical programs that we are advancing based on this human genetic data. So it's been really exciting to see the progress.
80% consent rate for research is really high. That's great. I also understand that 23andMe has been exploring clinical trial recruitment. Could you talk a little bit about that and how your data actually plays a role there?
This is another, I think, a really interesting use of the 23andMe platform. We're in such a unique position because we have now millions of customers who are on our platform and we're communicating with them electronically, and they're consented for research, but also for recontact. So we are able to go back to those customers to engage with them over time. And because we know what diseases they have and where they live geographically, we're in a unique position to match those individuals to clinical trials for which they may be appropriate. And this feels like such a great fit given, you know, we're seeing the huge problems faced by the industry. We've had a mushrooming of the number of clinical trials in recent years, and the challenge of finding patients is really significant. You know, 50% of clinical trial sites fail to enroll a single patient, and most trial sites are kind of using sort of the traditional methods for finding patients. And so we view ourselves as an innovator in this space to be able to connect patients with trials digitally and to do it really quickly. So the way that it works is a partner will come to us with their protocol for their clinical trial. And typically it's for a phase two or a phase three study. That's where most of our efforts are. And so that we'll take that protocol and we'll do a feasibility analysis and compare it against our database. Do we have enough patients? Do they live in the right geographies? And then assuming the feasibility analysis is positive, we will then initiate a recruitment campaign where we reach out via email to patients in our database who would be appropriate for the trial And then we do further screening that we just do online in real time. So we can check on things like, are you currently pregnant? What medications are you taking right now? To get really up to the minute information. And then they consent to share their contact information with the clinical trial sites. And we push that information over to the trial site for those individuals who can then be further screened and randomized into the study. So this is something that's been taking shape over the last couple of years for us and really expanding as our database has grown.
Do you have any success stories you could share? Like, have you successfully recruited patients to trials?
I can give you a couple of examples. A lot of the studies that we recruit for, it's based on the disease status. But there are some instances where we have recruited patients based on genetic profile. And that's a place where we obviously uniquely excel because we know the genetic profiles of our customers. So we were recruiting for a phase 3 trial in Alzheimer's, and they were specifically looking for people who were prodromal, so did not yet have Alzheimer's, but had a rare high-risk genetic variant that occurs in about 2% of the population. So these people were really hard to find because of this genetic variant. And the study itself was actually quite onerous. It's a 6-year interventional study because they're looking to try and prevent Alzheimer's disease. And so patients would have to go in over, you know, many, many years and, you know, and do some pretty invasive things given that it was Alzheimer's and they're trying to understand processes in the brain. And so we were able to identify about 4,000 people in our database who met all of the study criteria. And we reached out to those folks, and within literally a matter of weeks, we had generated nearly 750 referrals. So these are all people that met the high-level criteria. They were interested in the study. They wanted to learn more. And then we pushed those individuals to the clinical trial sites to then do the additional screening that was needed. And interestingly, we had a very low screen fail rate. So, you know, less than 2% of our referrals screen failed. And we think that that's because we're able to just really well qualify them right up front. And we had, in terms of the referrals, just about 10% of the referrals have been randomized at this point. And that effort is continuing to be ongoing. They still have some sites that they're getting up and running for the study. So the sponsor was really pleased that we were able to find these people so quickly and get them enrolled in their study. So that's an example around genetics. We have some other examples around, you know, that are focused more on phenotypic backgrounds. So like, for instance, we're recruiting for a trial in atopic dermatitis, where we're seeing very similar success rates and speed. We can do this very fast based on the fact that we're doing it digitally.
Continuing to talk about clinical trials. Now, artificial intelligence definitely has the potential to transform clinical trials. What excites you most about the scientific prospects of artificial intelligence?
You know, artificial intelligence is interesting. I you know, sometimes I think it can be a little bit of a buzzword, but I also think it's a fascinating area, you know, with the general concept being how do we get machines to learn like humans do? So there are places where, you know, I think of machine learning as kind of a subset of AI. So we use machine learning in a lot of different places at 23andMe. So for instance, we use machine learning when we're mining some of our data to try and understand risk for disease. And so we'll actually use machine learning to come up with these things called polygenic risk scores, essentially taking lots of different genetic variants and understanding how they inform risk for disease. So rather than just focusing on one or two genes, we could focus on 600 or 700 genes that may influence your risk and come together with an algorithm around those genes. And then those things can actually make it into our product. So we have a whole bunch of reports in our product where we're using polygenic risk scores. So for example, we report on genetics and body weight. And obviously body weight is influenced by many things, you know, diet and exercise, of course, but also genetics. And on the genetics, it's not just a single gene that influences weight. It's, in our model, it's about 400 genes. And so we've used machine learning to create a polygenic risk score, and then that is part of a report called genetic weight that our customers receive inside the product. We also use it for ancestry prediction. So another product feature that 23andMe customers received is a very detailed breakdown of their ancestry on kind of a percentage basis. So you're 67% Northern European, and then you can kind of dive into the specific geographies in more detail. And so we use machine learning to power a lot of those algorithms. And then on the more kind of basic science side, when we are understanding, when we're looking at kind of raw genetic data, to make sure that we're accurately interpreting that data, there's some algorithms that go into what's called variant calling. So just making sure I said your genotype is CT and that is accurately your genotype. So creating those algorithms, also we also leverage machine learning there. So we use it in a lot of places in the product. I'm excited to see, you know, more of these polygenic risk scores. I think much of human disease is multifactorial. So machine learning allows us to look at lots of different factors together at once. And then I think as a field, it's interesting, you know, obviously AI is being leveraged a lot around just disease diagnosis. There are places where we know that machines can perform better than humans. And so it's interesting to think about 5 or 10 years out what the medical field will look like.
And finally, Emily, what is 23andMe's vision for people using the knowledge provided by your test to improve their own health and healthcare?
We're a really mission-driven organization, and you know, our mission is to help people access, understand, and benefit from the human genome. And so we've really, on the access side, that has been a lot about going through the FDA so people can have direct access and not have the friction necessarily of requiring a healthcare provider. And then, you know, being able to understand that data through user comprehension studies and really great tools, you know, and then benefiting people based on the research. But when I kind of think about the overarching view for us, there's a big focus on prevention. Like if individuals are empowered with information about their genetic predispositions, it puts them in a position to take action. And, you know, right now we have a healthcare system that's very reactive. So you go to the doctor when you get sick, and the doctor can give you medicine. But we'd like to move toward a healthcare system where that's really preventive. You know, if I know I'm at risk of type 2 diabetes, wouldn't it be great if I took a bunch of action to prevent getting type 2 diabetes rather than actually getting sick and having to go in for treatment? And we think that 23andMe can really empower people. It can motivate them. It can give them the information they need to take preventative steps in their own healthcare in a very personalized way so that they're living healthier lives.
Prevention really is better than cure.
So, indeed. Emily,
thank you so much for your time today. It was lovely speaking with you.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
For DIA, I'm Ranjini Prithviraj.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.